Hello and welcome to Euractiv's Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food News Team.
So this week, two main events happened. One was the informal Agri-Fish Council, which was in the sunny Portugal.
I know. Actually, physical moving countries just seems so far away from possibility, doesn't it?
It's true. It's actually true that there was a physical one in under the previous presidency in Germany, which was in Koblenz, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was at the beginning of the beginning of September, and but for instance, Croatian didn't manage to organize a proper informal gathering of ministers, which is quite a nice occasion. I actually attended one under the Finnish presidency. It was quite nice. They basically, ministers are wandering in the rural areas of a certain country. Not only rural areas, but also having a direct contact with farmers. And,
I've heard a lot about this legendary Finnish trip. Yeah. Famous.
It was fine because in Finland there are a lot of forests and I actually planted a tree with this.
You did what? You found a tree?
No, a plant.
Oh, you planted a tree. Okay. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. With a very fancy tool, which has some kind of weird Finnish name. Basically, I remember we were basically doing the same things that the minister were doing, but with 30 minutes of distance in time, basically. So they we had two buses, and the minister had the bus ahead, and we were basically doing the same thing. And it was quite interesting and it was the same. I mean, we saw from Wojciechowski's Twitter page, they visited this Cork.
Yeah, a couple of farms. I think they went to a couple of different
farms. Cork farms, I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Had some nice pictures with some really lovely matching hats. It was like a family. It was like a family picture, you know. And the family says, all dress up the same and have a photo. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And the day after, Ed, of course, the informal, a normal session of the Agri-Fish Council. Informal, again, it wasn't an official one. There was also Norbert Linz, the chair of the Agriculture Parliament Committee, on behalf of course, his institution. There were also, someone else.
Yeah. So were all the major agricultural, policymakers and stakeholders. And there was also the attendance of EU Farmers Association Copacajeca, which was the attendant that sparked some controversy this week. And it's not the first time.
They were in Finland too.
They were in Finland too, yeah.
Well, it was, you know, the Secretary General of Copacajeca is Finnish.
Of course. Yes, of course. That makes sense. But I mean, yeah, so this has been going on for years, you know, so it's not the first time they've gone by any means, you know. It's not, it wasn't a huge shock to see them there to anyone. But over the last few years, you know, different stakeholders, different farmers associations and NGOs were kind of saying, well, you know, why is it just them that gets to go? Why nobody else? You know, obviously in the process of concluding these talks and this long road of this CAP reform, obviously, you know, policymakers will speak with all the stakeholders at any given moment and have all these different meetings and in the lead up. But Copacajeca is then the only stakeholder that is actually invited to this kind of final stage or this informal Agri-Fish Council. And so there was some controversy about this, and people were saying, you know, all other stakeholders need to be heard as well, and this kind of undermines the whole CAP reform. And so, yeah, I spoke with, actually at a press conference this week, I spoke with Portuguese agricultural minister who's the...
But not in Portugal.
Not in Portugal, unfortunately not. No, all still virtual. Girl can dream. One day, Gerardo will.
I promise the next one you'll be there.
Thank you. Big words.
It's all yours. The next
you said
one
it on the podcast be, now, so that means that's
Next one could be under the Slovenian presidency.
It's verbally binding here. So.
Or under the French one. So.
Going to Slovenia. Anyway, yeah, so I spoke to the current chair of the Agri-Fish Council, that's Maria Doshia Anshunish, and, you know, she didn't really give a very solid reason for why they were there, but she essentially said, you know, they're always here. And whereas the commissioner said he thought it was very important that they were there, and then also stressed that, you know, they heard all voices of farmers, you know, in the process of the CAP reform. But yeah, it really did kind of stir some drama this week. For their part, Kopukajaka, they were saying, well, our organization has by far the widest coverage across all the member states. You know, they're active in all the different sectors, including organic. You know, and he was saying, also, he kind of put his hands up and said, well, I mean, I was invited, you know. That's at the discretion of the rotating EU presidencies. It's their decision. It's up to them to decide. But yeah, increasingly, this is becoming a kind of topic each time this kind of comes around, this issue. Various NGOs and smaller farmers associations, or we spoke to European coordination Via Campesina, which is a farmers association that represents the voices of small and medium scale farmers. And, you know, they were actually protesting on the streets of Lisbon, where the informal council meeting was held, protesting for a fairer cap and also for their voices to be heard. So it will be interesting to see, you know, that they're calling basically on the next presidency not to reproduce this this kind of historical invitation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's like an acid test on how the environment around the common agricultural policy, you know, the stakeholder environment is changing. Because, I mean, we have this image of common agricultural policy as something that is basically, of course, regulated, decided by ministers and by members of the European Parliament, and that interests the relevant farmers association, national farmers association, or that are actually under the umbrella of Kopukajaka. But the fact that other organizations too are now a bit unhappy about this old habit of having just the farmers represented, just the, you know, the usual stakeholders, their voice represented by the good old representative, let's say, of farmers. It might be, you know, again, it's showing us that the
evolution
number,
maybe, of the,
yeah, the number of stakeholders interest in these talks is actually quite big already, and you don't have only NGOs or environmental non-profit organization, but also, as you said, other, I wouldn't say competitor, but
not competitors, other stakeholders, other voices, stakeholders, other perspectives.
Like, for instance, Via Campesina, as you mentioned, iPhone 2 is the... although Kopukajaka also represents the organic farmer.
Yeah. And actually, they did point out that iFOAM, the EU Organic Association, iFOAM, has been invited in the past. And so has the European Landowners Association, the ELO. Yeah.
Even the, well, again, when I was in Finland, the EEB, the European Environment Bureau, was invited and actually took the floor during the informal.
Oh, right.
So it's...
I suppose it's just funny, there's not really like a precedent. I mean, you can kind of invite who you want, but yeah, it's a...
Yeah, again, it was the first time that actually an NGO was invited, I remember.
Right.
I remember I covered it. I wasn't just having sauna with colleagues, and I was actually reporting. I was actually reporting.
Sure, that's what they all say.
Yeah, but
we believe you.
But yeah, it was kind of you know, something new, something you know, at first, you know, the first time the NGO was invited at an informal. While for again, it's more of an habit. Of our habit when we talk about Kopukajaka invited and something that is accepted, but you know, it's
well, that's again, kind of what the reaction from Minister Antunes was. You know, she was just, I mean, she was quite surprised when I asked the question.
Yeah.
She really was like taken aback, like, what? I mean, I don't know, like, this has just always happened, which is,
yeah.
I mean, you know, which is not really an argument in itself. Something's always happened. You'd think you maybe have to like actually reconsider what you're doing sometimes.
And the other event that I wanted to mention.
Tiny, tiny thing.
Of course, I mean, next week there will be the probably the potential final cup down. No, I mean, yes. There could be the last trilogue. On
the actual final countdown.
Yeah, I feel like I said this like four times now.
Yeah,
so
at least.
I'm not reliable anymore. So yeah, that, check on check.
Say that as a, check. Like, oh, listeners, no, don't listen to me. I'm not reliable.
Yeah, you can check on our website. You know, like randomly, and see if they finally find an agreement on this. There's also the Agrifish Council next. No, it's not. It's in 2 weeks. But the final trilogue is
next week.
Next week, 24th, 25th.
Yeah. Although we have to give a bit of a you know, not exactly a spoiler, the opposite of a spoiler to our listeners, our loyal listeners, who many of whom enjoyed our live blog, but we will not be doing a live blog, will we, Gerardo?
I mean, we don't. We probably won't do this.
Oh, it's gone from a no, absolutely never again, I mean, to a probably not.
It's quite demanding. It's actually
very demanding.
And but he and last time it was a bit different because it was we had at least 4 days of coverage because there was the trilogue plus the Agrifish Council. In this
it was
case,
super intense.
Yeah,
this was fun, but it was like.
No, but this is also interesting because it seems that the Portuguese presidency will not do this again. So basically the jumbo trilogue concept, which is something we kind of warn lawmakers in our interviews, because we had some like two or three interviews of people that actually attended the jumbo trilogue, and we actually asked them if it could have been a problem. Having in the same room 27 ministers, because there was
we pushed that question quite a lot of times. Yeah. And they're like,
and they were like, no, it's okay, don't worry. It's actually good. they won't follow this path again. So there will be a trilogue, and the outcome of this trilogue will be presented to ministers the week after. Mm-hmm. So there's no kind of direct link between the trial, because, you know, remember during the jumbo trilogue, you know, in the morning they were basically discussing, and then the Antunes came back to the council room with the other minister, updating them on the developments, let's call it that, and it's not going to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
The other interesting event was, of course, the visit of Joe Biden, the U.S. president, to Europe, actually. He actually reached the U.K. first, Cornwall, for the G7, and then Brussels for the NATO summit.
Mm-hmm.
And the day after, actually, was... in the EU district for this EU-US summit, and now is in Geneva, I think so, to talk with Vladimir Putin. Anyway,
the whole itinerary.
He did this trip, quite a trip, but during the EU-US summit, on the sidelines of this important agreement, no agreement, but I mean important meeting that tried to, how can I say, fix the struggling relationship across the Atlantic after, of course, the Trump administration. On the side end of this, there was an agreement, I mean, it was announced, the suspension of the retaliatory tariffs that were basically came after the WTO dispute over government subsidies to aircraft manufacturers, Airbus and Boeing, which actually affected the agri-food sector. Because I mean, this tariff were put on foodstuff, basically, from whiskey, wine, French wine, and so on.
I like that you named just the alcohol.
No, I mean, cheese too, you know.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it affected a huge amount of products, didn't it?
Indeed. And this is the thing that actually, basically, every lawmaker and stakeholder in the agri-food sector were telling during these months, actually years, because it lasts, it's since October 2019. It was that they basically got stuck in crossfire, because I mean, you know, it's something that affected disproportionately the agri-food sector, because we're talking about a controversy, a dispute happening because of subsidies in the aircraft manufacturing sector. So it was, you know, there was this kind of feeling of something not fair, of something that should have been fixed as soon as possible. And in the end, they had this, they agreed on this suspension for 5 years, actually. So it's not really settled. But according to the trade commissioner, the EU trade commissioner, Valdis Ondrovskis, this 5 year would be quite useful in order to find a permanent solution. Again, the agreement, the 5 year truce was accepted and welcomed by the entire agri-food sector, but yes, the main request is to find a permanent solution to this.
Well, it definitely gives more stability and predictability. Indeed. Than the few months, what was it, the reprieve before?
Four months, yeah.
4 months.
You said correct. Yeah, 4 months in March. Remember, there was this even meeting between the U.S. agriculture secretary and Wojciechowski, and they also not agreed, but I mean they agreed on a common agenda, no? Not only about the US tariffs, but also about the sustainability of the food system, which is at the top of the Commission agenda. But it seems it's important for the Biden administration too.
And in other news, there was an interesting referendum that happened in Switzerland last week, or could have been interesting, but I won't say too much about it because our guest this week is here to talk all about this. So today we have with us Georgina Downs. Georgina is a journalist and also a campaigner. She campaigns against the use of pesticides, and here's what she had to say about the referendum about the use of pesticides also in the UK. So we invited you on here today, I mean, in the context of there was this recent referendum in Switzerland, which was could have potentially banned synthetic pesticides. I'm wondering, can you tell us a little bit more about this? What was it? How did it come about? And, you know, what was the outcome of this referendum?
The Switzerland referendum, it came about because although pesticide use had dropped 40% in the last decade, an independent group of citizens, including scientists, doctors and growers, rightly concluded that merely reducing pesticides a bit is just wholly inadequate, as it only needs to have one single exposure incident to result in significant damage to human health or to other species exposed. And there are indeed some countries where these pesticide reduction targets, which I have to say are often put forward by many of the pesticide and environmental NGOs, you know, such targets have spectacularly failed. For example, the 50% reduction target that was previously set in France, along with a pesticide tax, it just didn't work. And in fact, wasted the last 10 years as agricultural pesticide use in France has overall increased over the last decade. And I would also just add that those pushing for the mere reduction of pesticides also sends the wrong message, as it implies it's okay to use these poisons, but just less. Well, it was never okay to use toxic chemicals in our food production systems, and certainly not for spraying in the locality of unprotected rural residents and communities like, you know, myself, my parents here in the UK, and many others, not only in the UK, but in all countries around the world. So what the independent group of Swiss citizens did was to force the referendum. They had recognised that the only real solution for the protection of both human health and the environment is for the full prohibition of use of all synthetic chemical pesticides, which, you know, I have to say is especially crucial in relation to agricultural use, as it's the biggest sector most countries go globally. And so these citizens campaigned for a complete ban on both agricultural and non-agricultural use of pesticides under the campaign title For a Switzerland Without Artificial Pesticides. Unfortunately, but probably as expected, there was very strong opposition to the proposal from the pesticide industry, the farming bodies, and others wanting to protect financial and business interests. And indeed, they did the usual sort of scaremongering tactic, which I think is what swung it in the end, of saying that without pesticides, there would be no food and everyone would go hungry. Yet, you know, this claim has already been debunked in a UN report of the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food in 2017 that concluded, and this is the actual quote from the UN's report, it said the assertion promoted by the agrochemical industry that pesticides are necessary to achieve food security is not only inaccurate but dangerously misleading. In principle, there is adequate food to feed the world. Inequitable production and distribution systems present major blockages that prevent those in need from accessing it. And in fact, I go further than that, obviously, than to say that rather than not being enough food, there's actually a huge amount of food wasted every year. One UK report here found that as much as half of all the worldwide food produced ends up as waste. And that is a whopping 2 billion tonnes every year. So, you know, the Swiss proposal for prohibition of pesticides didn't pass, but it did get very significant support across the country and had almost 40% in favour. And so I have to say, absolute huge hats off to all of my Swiss campaigning counterparts to have even got the vote. It's getting the truth and facts recognised on pesticides amidst so much opposition. I can say from my own experience, is really, really very, very hard.
So from one campaign to another, you mentioned before your campaign, Georgina, which, if I understood correctly, it is against the use of synthetic pesticides in agriculture, but also in towns and parks. Do you think this ban could be feasible?
Well, I mean, the UK pesticides campaign that I run here in the UK, I have to say the majority of reports that I receive from those affected are suffering adverse health impacts is from rural residents and communities. And that's not really surprising, considering that the biggest sector for pesticide use in the UK per year is the agriculture sector. I mean, 80%, around 80% or just over of pesticide used in the UK every year is agriculture. So you've got a smaller percentage, it's around 4% of non-agricultural use. So therefore, statistically, it's not surprising that there's more people reporting adverse health impacts from agriculture. I think a ban is, you know, it's certainly feasible in relation to agricultural use. I mean, there's been studies that have found non-chemical methods can produce equivalent yield to crops grown with pesticides. And obviously, when it's non-chemical methods, it's without the damaging effects on human health, on the environment, on other species, and on society in general. So, yeah, I think there was one study that found that there was actually an increase in yield of up to 250%. So there's a lot of studies out there that have shown that farming can live and can survive without these toxic chemicals. And you've also got an increasing number of you know, very significant people who are recognising that prohibiting pesticides really is the only way forward from this pesticide crisis that's ever deepening and ever increasing, including, for example, the UN report on the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food that I mentioned earlier. They actually concluded that, you know, moving away from pesticide-reliant industrial agriculture to non-chemical farming methods should now be a political priority in all countries globally. Even the former Chief Scientific Advisor, Professor Ian Boyd, who was the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs in the UK, Chief Scientific Advisor for many years, he issued a damning assessment of the regulatory approach globally for pesticides sprayed on crops, including that the impacts of dose whole landscapes has been ignored, that the assumption by regulators that it's safe to use pesticides at industrial scales across landscapes is false, and that, you know, it must change. And he's actually repeatedly advocated since then that pesticides need to be designed out of farming systems altogether. So he obviously feels that there is a way forward without having to rely on these chemicals. And as I say, there's numerous studies to show that there is a way of doing it without having to use pesticides. And, you know, there's more and more people now who are recognising that the only way forward to protect human health and the environment from the catastrophic impacts that are, you know, they've been going on for decades, not just here in the UK, not just in Switzerland, but obviously around Europe and globally, you've got, you know, billions of people that live next to sprayed fields in all of these countries that have crop spraying that takes place. And there's just no protection whatsoever for rural residents and communities. Operators, you know, generally have protection when using agricultural pesticides. They'll be in PPE, personal protective equipment. They'll have respirators. They'll be in, you know, filter tractor cabs when they're spraying the pesticides. But we residents, we just have absolutely no protection whatsoever. And that's been the main focus of my campaign for the last 20 years, trying to get, you know, protection for people who are the most exposed. And even the European legislation on pesticides, the authorization of pesticides, recognizes in one of its articles and definitions that rural residents are a vulnerable group exposed to pesticides, very high levels of pesticides over the long term. So it's the only way forward really is to prohibit use and find different forms of farming that don't put human health and the environment and other species at risk of harm.
And you mentioned there already, you spoke about the UK and you mentioned DEFRA, the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs in the UK. There's talks of restrictions elsewhere and there's talks ongoing in the UK as well. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about this environment bill that's going through the UK Parliament at the moment, which carries an amendment restricting their use. And I know that you did a lot of work on that.
Yeah. The Environment Bill is currently going through the House of Lords here in the UK. And there is a crucial amendment. It's just been tabled actually in the last few days for prohibiting the application of agricultural pesticides in the locality of residents' homes, schools, nurseries, hospitals, other healthcare facilities in order to protect human health and the environment in rural areas. And this is actually the same protection measure that is called for in an ongoing petition here in the UK. And that's been signed by over 13,500 mainly affected rural residents and communities, but also by a number of prominent figures, including the Hillsborough QC, Michael Mansfield, as well, believe it or not, as the Prime Minister's own father, Stanley Johnson.
Okay, got an endorsement there.
he signed and supported the petition as well. And also just to point out that this vital amendment has actually been tabled by a former DEFRA Minister for Food and Farming, Lord Whitty, and is co-signed by the former advisor to the previous Prime Minister on the Theresa May. So he was an advisor to her on the environment, Lord Randall of Uxbridge. So it really does have some very, very significant support from some key people. And it's also, this particular amendment actually got adopted into the Agriculture Bill last year, following widespread full cross-party support in the House of Lords, including the main opposition front benches, which is obviously Labour and Liberal Democrat, who have been very supportive of this amendment. But you know, very disappointingly, it was taken out again at the final stages in the House of Commons, and that was due to the Conservative majority in the Commons. So, but it's obviously essential to now get this amendment into the Environment Bill. You know, as I say, rural residents and communities have no protection. This would actually provide, you know, protection for such a vulnerable group, including, you know, babies, children, pregnant women, elderly people, people who are already ill. We all live, you know, next to these fields that are regularly sprayed, and you cannot control pesticides once they've been dispersed. They're airborne particles, droplets and vapours. And indeed, you know, volatilization, which is vapours that lift off crop sometime after application, that can occur days, weeks, even months after spraying. So it's not just a case of immediate spray drift at the time of the application. It's all the airborne pollution and contamination that you have thereafter. And that is obviously ongoing for residents. We live permanently, you know, next to these fields, and there's just ongoing spraying throughout every year. And if you're someone like myself and my family, we've lived next to sprayed fields for 35 years. So we've had an extraordinary amount of exposure to these chemicals and had blood tests and blood samples and fat samples taken to show pesticides within our bodies. Me in particular has a whole raft of neurotoxic chemicals found in my system. And it's not surprising, therefore, that I have, you know, ongoing neurological condition and other health problems. These chemicals are known to be toxic. They're known to be harmful to various systems in the body. You know, high quality peer-reviewed scientific studies and reviews have concluded that long-term exposure to pesticides, like what residents receive, it can damage the function of different systems in the body, including the nervous, endocrine, immune system, reproductive system, renal, cardiovascular, respiratory. There's just a whole raft of systems. It's difficult to think of a system in the body that isn't impacted by these chemicals. So there has to be protection for the most vulnerable groups in relation to the exposure of these chemicals, and that is rural residents and communities who have absolutely no protection so far.
Since I'm the only one that is not coming from the UK, I'm going to ask a very practical, in this convo, of course, I'm going to ask a very practical question. If this will pass, what would this mean in practice for the UK, and particularly on what kind of timescale?
Well, if this amendment is adopted, which obviously rural residents and communities across the UK will be hoping that it is, and this time it stays in the bill, unlike the agriculture bill when it was only in for 3 weeks. But, you know, there would be regulations drafted for the prohibition to be introduced, and that would then specify a distance to be set following consultation and what size the prohibition areas would need to be in order to have a significant protective effect for rural residents and communities. I mean, for example, it goes without saying that a small buffer zone of a few metres is not going to protect anyone. And indeed, scientific studies have in fact found pesticides transported in the air at very high levels, including at considerable distances away from where they were applied, up to you know, a number of miles. I mean, there was a California study that found up to 3 miles away pesticides from where the application site was. And obviously, they also calculated in such studies the health risks for rural residents and communities living within those distances. As I said earlier, obviously includes, you know, some of the most vulnerable subgroups: babies, children, pregnant women, elderly, those already ill or disabled. I mean, none of us should have been exposed to these harmful chemicals in the first place. It's an absolute given that you know, protection needs to be introduced, not just here, but obviously in other countries around the world, and that the distances where pesticides are prohibited, you know, need to be substantial in order to properly be protective of rural residents and communities.
So that's all from us this week. And this week, like every week, the Euractiv Agri-Food podcast was produced by Euractiv's Agri-Food News team. That's Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foote, with the support of Euractiv's podcast producer, Evie Curie. And you can also find this podcast on all major streaming platforms. That's Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher.
And be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agriculture news from the EU. I'm Gerardo Fortuna. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.